into a floating dock, which, while firmly attached to its moorings and not therefore at the caprice of the waves, yet rises and falls with the tide of time and circumstance. Law Professor Thomas Reed Powell, assessing Beck's work in a contemptuous review in the New Republic, remarked that Beck's constitution moves neither forward nor backward. It jiggles up and down, like jello. Powell proposed to write a volume of Becksniffian songs of innocence to include this verse. The constitution is a dock that's moored yet tosses to and fro. It's not a beach, it's not a rock, and that is why we love it so. The feud between Beck and Powell was no petty squabble, but instead suggested a deep and widening chasm. The argument over the nature of the Constitution had much in common with the argument between Protestants who believed the Bible to be literally true and those who did not. Beck was a constitutional fundamentalist, Powell a believer in evolution. Harding's agenda of undoing progressive reforms, outlined in his inauguration, brought together Solicitor General Beck's understanding of the Constitution with Frederick Winslow Taylor's gospel of efficiency. Taylorism had by now been applied to office work, to the very kind of work done by the government itself. Office workers sat at the new modern efficiency desk, a metal slab topping file drawers, usually two on each side. They punched cards into time clocks and used typewriters and adding machines manufactured by the Computing Tabulating Recording Company, founded in 1911 through a consolidation of companies that included Herman Hollerith's Tabulating Machine Company. A 1923 play called The Adding Machine lampooned the monotony of assembly line office work and prefigured fears about machine automation. Its main character, Mr. Zero, writes down numbers all day long upon a square sheet of ruled paper. When his boss tells him that he will be replaced by an adding machine, he murders him. What any office worker might know how to do got smaller and smaller, like the skills of factory workers, while the businesses people worked for got bigger and bigger, including, by 1924, IBM. "We must study through reading, listening, discussing, observing, and thinking," said the company's founder, Thomas Watson. Its motto was think, which is what employees were asked to do, but observers worried, and more as the years passed, that thinking was becoming the work of machines. Harding wanted to Taylorize the federal government. "I speak for administrative efficiency," Harding said in one of the worst inaugural addresses ever delivered, "for lightened tax burdens, for sound commercial practices, for adequate credit facilities, for sympathetic concern for all agricultural problems, for the omission of unnecessary interference of government with business, for an end to government's experiments in business, and for more efficient business and government administration." With efficiency as his watchword, Harding assembled an extraordinary cohort of conservative businessmen in his cabinet who headed the federal government during some of the most prosperous years in American history. Between 1922 and 1928, industrial production rose by 70%, gross national product by almost 40%, per capita income by 30%, and real wages by 22%. The nation was electrified in the 1920s, too, as a new power grid reached businesses and residences alike. In 1916, only 16% of Americans lived in homes with electricity, but by 1927, that percentage had risen to 63%. As Secretary of Treasury, Harding appointed Andrew W. Mellon, an industrialist and philanthropist and the fourth wealthiest man in America, after John D. Rockefeller Jr., Henry Ford, and Edsel Ford. Mellon, who would hold the office under three Republican presidents, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, aimed to bring efficiency to taxation. As Mellon argued in Taxation, the People's Business, 1924, high taxes kill the spirit of business adventure. Cutting taxes, Mellon insisted, would lower the cost of housing, reduce prices, raise the standard of living, create jobs, and advance general prosperity. Mellon's bid for public support for his tax policy was greatly aided by the American Taxpayers League, formerly known as the American Bankers League, and bankrolled in part by members of the Mellon family, which sponsored, provided literature to, and paid the expenses of state tax clubs, whose members then testified before Congress urging tax cuts. "Taxes are what we pay for civilized society," Oliver Wendell Holmes said in 1927, words later engraved in front of the IRS building in Washington. But Americans by no means uniformly agreed. During Mellon's tenure, Congress abolished the excess profits tax, cut the estate tax, exempted capital gains from income, and capped the top tax rate. As Secretary of Commerce, Harding appointed Herbert Hoover. Born into austere poverty in the Quaker town of West Branch, Iowa, and orphaned at the age of 9, Hoover had gone on to study geology at Stanford. As a mining engineer and organizational genius, he made a fortune in Australia and China and became a staggeringly successful international businessman, a millionaire 10 times over by the time he retired from business at the age of 37 to devote himself to public service and philanthropy. He'd lived most of his life outside the United States. Both during and after the war, he'd headed humanitarian relief efforts in Europe, helping to save tens of millions of lives. When Wilson won the Nobel Peace Prize, not a few Europeans thought Hoover more deserving. When he returned to the United States, he'd become a dazzlingly popular guest at Lippmann's House of Truth. Many felt, as I did, Lippmann said, that they had never met a more interesting man. In 1920, both parties had urged him to run for president. But though he dipped a toe in the waters of the Republican primaries, he quietly lost the nomination to Harding. Hoover was an efficiency expert, best known for an influential 400-page report called Waste in Industry. So great was his fame that nearly anything involving the elimination of waste, including vacuum cleaning, took his name. Although opposed to big government, Hoover understood his role as Secretary of Commerce as giving him control over the entire American economy. From his office on the top floor of a building on the corner of 19th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, he brought the department's many bureaus into rooms below him. With daunting efficiency, he expanded commerce, making himself undersecretary of all other departments, to realize his plan of a new era. What Hoover designed was an associative state, bringing in business and labor leaders, farmers and fishermen, to cooperative meetings to order the government's priorities. During Hoover's tenure, the department's budget grew to almost 6 times its previous size, from $860,000 to $5 million. "Never before here or anywhere else has a government been so completely fused with business," the Wall Street Journal reported. During the 1920s, Americans' faith in progress turned into a faith in prosperity, fueled by consumption. "A change has come over our democracy," a journalist reported. "It is called consumptionism. The American citizen's first importance to his country is now no longer that of citizen, but that of consumer." By any measure, the American economy was getting bigger and bigger. The United States was the world's biggest lender, and its economy was the largest in the world. By 1929, it produced 42% of the world's output. Great Britain, France, and Germany together produced 28%. Steel production and railroad income broke all records, graphs of growth reaching higher and higher, like the skyscrapers towering over New York's Fifth Avenue, Chicago's Michigan Avenue, and San Francisco's California Street. And yet the nation turned inward. Before the war, most of the industrial world followed a policy of open borders for both goods and people. People left Europe for other parts of the world, especially the United States, while Europeans invested capital in building projects in their colonies. The devastation of the war and the brutal terms of the peace, especially for Germany, meant an end to these arrangements. After the war, the United States became the center of global trade and yet soon began closing its borders to both people and goods. In 1921 and 1922, Harding and a Republican Congress raised taxes on imports, and in 1921 and 1924, they placed restriction on immigration. European countries devastated by the war were unable to send excess workers across the Atlantic, and unable to sell their manufactured goods in the United States, were left unable to repay American lenders the money they owed them. In retaliation, European countries raised tariffs too, depriving American farmers and manufacturers of a market. And so began a vicious economic spiral. "It's a marvel looking back on it now," Lippmann would later write ruefully, "that we could ever have so completely thought that a boom under such treacherous conditions was permanent." Harding's administration labeled its economic program a return to normalcy. Its political program was a campaign against immigration, its cultural program an aesthetic movement known as the Colonial Revival. Both looked inward and backward, inventing and celebrating an American heritage, a fantasy world of a past that never happened. Philanthropic industrialists fortified their vision of the nation's past. Henry Ford building an American History Museum, John Rockefeller restoring Colonial Williamsburg, history as a life-sized dollhouse. R.T.H. Halsey, who had a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, had led the effort to defend the banks against Theodore Roosevelt's attack on the money trust. Relinquishing his seat on the exchange, he helped curate a new American wing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Unveiled in 1924, it displayed American fine and decorative arts from before 1825. "Much of the America of today has lost sight of its traditions," Halsey warned. "Many of our people are not cognizant of our traditions and the principles for which our fathers struggled and died." For Halsey, the contemplation of the past was meant to provide a warning about the present. The tremendous changes in the character of our nation and the influx of foreign ideas utterly at variance with those held by the men who gave us the Republic threaten, and unless checked, may shake the foundations of our Republic. The year the American wing opened, Congress passed the Immigration Act. It had two parts, an Asian Exclusion Act extending the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, all but banned immigrants from anywhere in Asia, and a National Origins Act, which restricted the annual number of European immigrants to 150,000 and established a quota by which the number of new arrivals was made proportional to their representation in the existing population. The act instantiated the eugenicist logic of Madison Grant's passing of the Great Race. The purpose of the quota system was to end immigration from Asia and to curb the admission of Southern and Eastern Europeans deemed less worthy than immigrants from other parts of Europe, said Indiana Republican Fred S. Purnell. There is little or no similarity between the clear-thinking, self-governing stocks that sired the American people and this stream of irresponsible and broken wreckage that is pouring into the lifeblood of America, the social and political diseases of the old world. New York Republican Nathan D. Perlman, a Jewish lawmaker and an opponent of immigration restriction, read into the congressional record the names of Americans of all ethnicities who had been awarded the Distinguished Service Cross during the war. He argued in vain. The immigration restriction regime begun in 1924 hardened racial lines, institutionalized new forms of race-based discrimination, codified a fiction of a white race, and introduced a new legal category into American life, the illegal alien. Europeans, deemed white, classified into their national origins, and ranked according to their desirability, could immigrate in limited numbers. Entering the United States as legal aliens, they could become naturalized citizens. Chinese, Japanese, Indians, and other Asians, deemed non-white, could not immigrate into the United States legally, were deemed unassimilable, and were excluded from citizenship on racial grounds. More profoundly, the law categorized Europeans as belonging to nations. They were sorted by national origin, but categorized non-Europeans as belonging to races. They were sorted into five colored races: black, mulatto, Chinese, Japanese, and Indian. Notably, the 1924 Immigration Act did not restrict immigration from Mexico, even though it, too, had been on the rise. Between 1890 and 1920, some 1.5 million Mexicans crossed into the United States, fleeing the dictator José de la Cruz Porfirio Díaz, especially after the revolt against him in 1910. Mexican Americans who had lived in the American Southwest for decades tended to retain their language and culture, and to live in urban barrios. They often resented these new arrivals, los recién llegados. Newer Mexican immigrants were most often employed picking produce on newly irrigated agricultural tracts. In 1890, irrigated land in California, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona totaled about 1.5 million acres, but by 1902, there were 2 million irrigated acres in California alone. After the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, large growers had turned to Japanese laborers, but a so-called gentleman's agreement between Japan and the United States ended their migration in 1908, after which growers began sending employment agents over the border and into Mexico to recruit workers. In an era when the regime of scientific management maligned Hungarians, Italians, and Jews as near animals who needed to be ruled not by the lash but by the stopwatch, business owners and policymakers tended to describe Mexican immigrants, desperately poor political refugees, as ideal workers. In 1908, U.S. government economist Victor S. Clark claimed that Mexican immigrants were docile, patient, usually orderly in camp, fairly intelligent under competent supervision, obedient, and cheap. In 1911, a U.S. congressional panel reported that while Mexicans are not easily assimilated, this is not of very great importance as long as most of them return to their native land after a short time. But of course, Mexicans who crossed the border in search of work did not always return to Mexico. During the debate over immigration restriction, Indiana Congressman Albert H. Vestal asked, "What is the use of closing the front door to keep out undesirables from Europe when you permit Mexicans to come in here by the back door, by the thousands and thousands?" Edward Taylor, a congressman from Colorado, answered that no one but Mexican immigrants would do the work they were hired to do. "The American laboring people will not get down on their hands and knees in the dirt and pull weeds and thin these beets and break their backs doing that kind of work. In fact, there are very few people who can stand that kind of work, no matter how much they are paid. They cannot and will not do it." This did not quiet nativists, the American Eugenics Society warning. Our great Southwest is rapidly creating for itself a new racial problem, as our old South did when it imported slave labor from Africa. The Mexican birth rate is high, and every Mexican child born on American soil is an American citizen who, on attaining his or her majority, will have a vote. This is not a question of pocketbook, or of the need of labor, or of economics. It is a question of the character of future races. It is eugenics, not economics. Congress, pressured by eugenicists and southern and western agriculturalists, in the end exempted Mexicans from the new immigration restriction regime, while also requiring not only passports but also visas for anyone entering the United States. Thus, it erected hurdles that allowed Mexicans to cross the border to work temporarily, but denied them access to citizenship. Over time, Mexicans assigned to a new category, Mexican, in the federal census, would become most closely tied to the new legal, racialized category of illegal alien. Before 1919, Mexicans who entered the United States at the border did not need to apply for entry. After the formation of the U.S. Border Patrol in 1924, soldiers armed points of entry and deportation of illegal aliens became U.S. government policy. In effect, the new regime of immigration restriction extended the black and white racial ideology of Jim Crow to new European immigrants, by classing them as white and eligible for citizenship, and Asians and Mexicans by classing them as non-white and ineligible. It drew support from a second Ku Klux Klan that had emerged in 1915. By the 1920s, its 5 million members attacked Jews and Catholics as vehemently as they attacked blacks. The Klan had provided vocal support for immigration restriction. At the Democratic National Convention in New York in 1924, thousands of members of the KKK marched in the streets of the city, and the party was so disarrayed and disorganized and so divided over matters relating to race that the convention took a record-breaking 103 ballots to nominate the unmemorable John W. Davis. Driven by a combustible mix of nativism and eugenics, political scientist Lothrop Stoddard rewrote American history as a history of white people. The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, Du Bois had written in 1903. Black intellectuals, especially the writers and artists of the Harlem Renaissance, countered the nostalgia of colonial revival with a new, critical attention to the nation's black past. "It's time to settle down to a realistic facing of facts," Elaine Locke wrote in The New Negro, 1925, a collection that included an essay called "The Negro Digs Up His Past." Stoddard answered with a book called The Rising Tide of Color Against the White World Supremacy, which blamed discontent and malaise in Europe on the darker races. Stumping for the Immigration Act, he argued that the same social problem had threatened to unravel the United States. By the end of the decade, he celebrated the triumph of immigration restriction. "We know that our America is a white America," Stoddard said during a debate with W.E.B. Du Bois on a stage in Chicago, "and the overwhelming weight of both historical and scientific evidence shows that only so long as the American people remain white will its institutions, ideas, and culture continue to fit with the temperament of its inhabitants, and hence continue to endure." "Your country?" Du Bois asked Stoddard. "How came it yours?" And then he pressed him. "Would America have been America without her Negro people?" Stoddard had no real answer. In the 1930s and into the 1940s, he applauded Hitler. He died, disgraced, and forgotten. But the debate he had with Du Bois over the nation's origins never ended. 4. We hold these truths to be self-evident. By 1926, a century and a half after the nation's birth, every word of its founding statement had been questioned. Who are we? What is true? What counts as evidence? American politics had become riven by disputes over basic matters of fact. At the heart of those disputes lay rival interpretations of the Constitution, which rested on different understandings of its nature, an extension of the debate over the literal truth of the Bible. But Americans also expressed their political differences in debates over science and history, debates that were shaped by the new business of public relations. Ivy Lee, one of the field's earliest practitioners, called it propaganda, which he defined as the effort to propagate ideas. Lee, born in Georgia in 1877, the son of a Methodist minister, worked as a newspaper reporter before taking on assignments representing the interests of railroad corporations, attempting to get them better press. Among his earliest clients were John D. Rockefeller, who was attempting to recover from the damage to his reputation by Ida Tarbell's muckraking into Standard Oil, and Bethlehem Steel, suffering from the taint of Taylor-induced strikes. Carl Sandburg called Lee a paid liar. Upton Sinclair named him Poison Ivy. In a speech to journalism teachers in the 1920s, Lee argued that facts don't exist, or at least that they can't be reported. The effort to state an absolute fact is simply an attempt to achieve what is humanly impossible. All I can do is give you my interpretation of the facts. Journalists, especially reporters who'd served in the war, tended to disagree. In 1923, when two young Army veterans, Henry Luce and Britton Haddon, decided to found a magazine, they wanted to call it Facts. In the end, they decided to call it Time, with the idea that, in an age of efficiency, it would save readers' time. Time was meant to offer busy readers, and especially businessmen, a week's worth of news that could be read in an hour. Each issue was to contain 100 articles, none over 400 words long, full of nothing but the facts, put together, at first, by cutting sentences out of 7 days' worth of newspapers and pasting them onto pages. Using a Taylor system of task management, Luce and Haddon sorted the news into categories, something that hadn't been done before. Despite its speed, brevity, and simplicity, Time claimed to be free from error, a record of events accurately chronicled, which wasn't the same thing as making a claim for objectivity. "Show me a man who thinks he's objective, and I'll show you a man who's deceiving himself," Luce once said. Objectivity was impossible. Subjectivity led to the introduction of errors. The best that could be done would be to check every article for errors of fact. Time established the practice of fact-checking, and an elaborate method of checking fact by fact, as if knowledge could be reduced to units, like parts on an assembly line. To do this work, they hired young women just out of college. "Charged with verifying every word, they put a dot over each one to signify that they have," a visiting reporter observed. The author of an early manual for Times checkers advised them, "Checking is sometimes regarded as a dull and tedious occupation, but such a conception of this position is extremely erroneous. Any bright girl who readily applies herself to the handling of the checking problem can have a very pleasant time with it and fill the week with happy moments and memorable occasions. The most important point to remember in checking is that the writer is your natural enemy. He is trying to see how much he can get away with. Remember that when people write letters about mistakes, it is you who will be screeched at, so protect yourself." When readers wrote complaining of errors, Time published the letters and printed corrections. Its editors kept a black book in which every error was entered, with its correction. This practice reached a fervid intensity at the nearby offices of Time's chief rival, The New Yorker, a magazine established in opposition to everything Time stood for, except for its obsession with facts. In the fall of 1924, Harold Ross, a former city newspaper reporter, and like Luce and Haddon, a veteran of the First World War, wrote a prospectus for The New Yorker, a magazine that was not meant to save anyone even a moment of time. But like Luce and Haddon, Ross disavowed error, fraud, and nonsense, and especially of the PR kind. Ross promised, "It will hate bunk." "A special effort should be made to avoid mistakes in The New Yorker," Ross announced, after they committed a doozy. One writer said Ross clung to facts the way a drowning man clings to a spar. Later, he sent a memo to one of his editors, "Add fact-checking to your list of chores." But if journalists were finding new devices to recommit themselves to accuracy in reporting, businesses were using the tools of public relations to make sure the press heard their particular side of every story. No man played a greater role in this transformation than Edward Bernays, a nephew of Sigmund Freud, who used Freud's theory of the unconscious to help businesses sell their products to American consumers. Born in Vienna, Bernays had grown up in New York. When the war started, he worked for George Creel's Office of War Propaganda and traveled with Wilson to the Paris peace talks where, he liked to say, his services had been invaluable. Returning to civilian life, he began a career in public relations, which he described as applied social science, but which the nation called the higher hokum. In 1924, Bernays met with Calvin Coolidge, who descended to the presidency in 1923 after Harding's sudden death. Bernays decided Coolidge's image as a sturdy, crusty Vermonter would be improved by glamour, and so arranged to have Hollywood film stars visit the White House. "Good propaganda is an invisible government which sways the habits and actions of most of the people of the United States," Bernays explained. "Rightly employed, it is a quick and effective means of producing changes of social usefulness." Propaganda used to run political campaigns would make democracies run more efficiently. "Honest propaganda, efficiently applied, will save millions in the next political campaign," he predicted. In his 1928 book, Propaganda, Bernays explained that he'd also been influenced by Walter Lippmann's Public Opinion, having read Lippmann's concern for a gullible public as an opportunity for a canny publicist. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in a democratic society, Bernays insisted. For Bernays, propaganda was to the masses what the unconscious was to the mind, a people's invisible governors. The tragedy that this spelled for the mass democracy of the United States played before the public on a stage in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee, over five long days in the summer of 1925, at the trial of a high school biology teacher named John Scopes, who was charged with the crime of teaching the theory of evolution. William Jennings Bryan, 65, his broad head grown bald, led the prosecution, having captained the campaign to ban the teaching of evolution in the nation's schools. Not all fundamentalists rejected evolution, believing, as R.A. Torrey, the editor of The Fundamentals, that a Christian could believe thoroughly in the absolute infallibility of the Bible and still be an evolutionist of a certain type. But Bryan's own views, like those of many fundamentalists, had hardened on the matter after the war, whose horrors so many tried but could not fathom to reconcile with a loving God. Evolution is not truth, Bryan pointed out. It is merely a hypothesis. It is millions of guesses strung together. But what he especially decried was its application to human societies. In 1921, in an essay called The Menace of Darwinism, he had explained his support for a raft of progressive reforms whose intention was to check the very idea that only the fittest should survive. Pure food laws have become necessary to keep manufacturers from poisoning their customers. Child labor laws have become necessary to keep employers from dwarfing the bodies, minds, and souls of children. Antitrust laws have become necessary to keep overgrown corporations from strangling smaller corporations. And we are still in a death grapple with profiteers and gamblers and farm products. Bryan saw, in a secular modernity, the end of sympathy, compassion, and charity. He decried the heartlessness of science. Men who would not cross the street to save a soul have traveled across the world in search of skeletons, he said in a 1923 speech to the West Virginia legislature. The great need of the world today is to get back to God, he wrote. With Bryan, fundamentalism, which had begun as a theological dispute about facts and truth, became a populist movement about faith. In 1925, after Tennessee became the first state to ban the teaching of evolution, the American Civil Liberties Union convinced Scopes to test the law. The ACLU had been founded in 1917 to defend conscientious objectors, work that grew still more urgent during the Red Scare, an anti-Bolshevik hysteria that had gripped the United States in the last years of the war. The rights of both individuals and minorities are being grossly violated throughout the country, its founder wrote. It had since extended into peacetime its wartime mission of protecting Americans from assaults on civil liberties. Its interest in the Tennessee law, like Scopes' own, had nothing to do with religion and everything to do with free speech. Scopes was himself a churchgoer and an admirer of Bryan, who had been the speaker at his high school graduation in Illinois in 1919. The ACLU expected and planned for Scopes to be found guilty, after which the law could be appealed to a higher court. That plan changed when Bryan was persuaded to join the prosecution and named as a counsel to the Tennessee Attorney General. Bryan's involvement led Clarence Darrow to pledge to defend Scopes. Darrow was big and ornery, broad-shouldered and craggy, and liked to pretend he was a Cracker Barrel philosopher with his baggy pants and his suspenders and string tie. Everything about Darrow suggests a cynic, one reporter said. Everything but one thing, and that is an entire lack of real cynicism. In his long and justly famous career as the nation's best-known trial lawyer, he played a role in some 2,000 trials. In more than a third of those cases, he was paid nothing. But the Scopes trial was the only trial in which he had volunteered his services. Darrow and Bryan had both grown up on farms, become country lawyers, and fought for underdogs and for the poor their whole lives. They'd fought the same fight, Bryan as the great commoner, Darrow as the attorney for the damned. They spoke the same language. In 1903, when Darrow represented the United Mine Workers in Pennsylvania in arbitration, he told the court, $500 a year is a big price for taking your life and your limbs in your hand and going down into the earth to dig up coal to make somebody else rich. Bryan could have said those words. But Darrow knew that for all that Bryan's campaign against the teaching of evolution was a campaign against social Darwinism and a campaign for the underdog, it was also an assault on science. And Darrow couldn't take that, nor could most people who'd fought on the same side of the labor question as Brian. By 1924, Eugene Debs, a longtime Brian supporter, had taken to referring to Brian as this shallow-minded mouther of empty phrases, this pious canting mountebank, this prophet of the Stone Age. Darrow agreed. He had been raised reading Charles Darwin and Frederick Douglass. His interest was in education. "I knew that education was in danger from the source that has always hampered it, religious fanaticism," he said. He considered Brian the idol of all morondom. Dayton had two paved streets and a movie theater that fit 75 people. The trial became a circus as the town was flooded with more than 100 journalists, dozens of preachers and psalm singers, and not least trained chimpanzees. "The thing is genuinely fabulous," H.L. Mencken reported in the Baltimore Sun. "I've stored up enough material to last me 20 years." No one disputed that Scopes had violated the law. The defense hoped to litigate the reasonableness of the law itself. It began by bringing in a parade of biologists to demonstrate that evolution is a science. "This is not the place to try to prove that the law ought never to have been passed," Brian said. "The place to prove that or to teach that was to the legislature." But Brian, as much as Darrow, if not more, wanted to put evolution on trial. The judge sided with Brian and refused to allow the testimony of the biologists to be heard by the jury. The next day, it was so hot inside the courtroom that the judge moved the trial to the lawn in front of the courthouse. The defense then called none other than Brian himself to the witness stand as an expert on the Bible. "You've given considerable study to the Bible, haven't you, Mr. Brian?" Darrow asked. "Yes, sir, I have tried to." But Brian was no theologian. For 2 long hours, Darrow sliced and diced him like a spring ham. Was the earth really made in 6 days? Had Jonah really been swallowed by a whale? If Eve was made of Adam's rib, how did Cain get his wife? Brian flustered, stammered. Darrow pressed, Brian sweated, and made very little sense. "The only purpose Mr. Darrow has is to slur the Bible," Brian complained. "I object to your statement," said Darrow. "I am examining you on your fool ideas that no intelligent Christian on earth believes." The judge ordered Brian's testimony expunged from the record. The jury found Scopes guilty, and 5 days later, Brian died in his sleep while taking a nap, while his wife was reading a newspaper on a porch outside his window. The boy of the plains, the great commoner, a 3-time presidential candidate, had been felled, according to the wire service, the victim of his last great battle. Fundamentalism did not die when Brian's head fell on his pillow. Fundamentalism endured, and the challenge it posed to the nation's founding principles, and especially to the nature of truth, would be felt well into the 21st century. Darrow was not among those who believed that the Scopes trial, followed so swiftly by Brian's death, had closed the book on fundamentalism. "I'm pained to hear of Brian's death," said a sober Darrow. "I've known Brian since 1896 and supported him twice for the presidency." But the idea that modernity had killed William Jennings Bryan took hold, and mere weeks after his death, big city reporters and above all H.L. Mencken were back to lampooning Bryan and his followers as dumb hicks. Well, privately, Mencken confessed that he was terrified of the people he'd met on that courthouse lawn in Dayton. Their bigotry and fury set him shuddering. "I set out laughing," Mencken wrote to a friend, "and returned shivering." Walter Lippmann didn't shiver, and he didn't lampoon. Instead, he sat down to think through the consequences of the argument Brian had made in Dayton for the freedom of religion, freedom of inquiry, and the separation of church and state. For Lippmann, the battle between Brian and Darrow wasn't about evolution. It was about how people decide what's true. Does truth derive from faith or from reason? And more deeply, what happens in a democracy when people can't agree about how they decide what's true? Does the majority rule? Lippmann traced the question back to Thomas Jefferson. In Virginia's 1786 bill for the establishing of religious freedom, Jefferson had stated the principle that to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. In Tennessee's 1925 Act prohibiting the teaching of evolutionary theory, the state legislature had banned the teaching of the evolutionary theory in all the universities, normal, and all other public schools of Tennessee, which are supported in whole or in part by the public school funds of the state. Brian, alluding to the principle stated by Jefferson, had asked, "What right has a little irresponsible oligarchy of self-styled intellectuals to demand control of the schools of the United States in which 25 millions of children are being educated at an annual expense of $10 billion? Didn't their demand for control violate not only the Tennessee statute, but religious freedom itself?" Darrow had settled this question in his own mind. I don't like onion soup, but you go ahead and have some, he liked to say. I wouldn't force my prejudice on you. Darrow liked to find refuge in an adage. But Lippman found that formulation wanting, because it wasn't a matter of one man liking onion soup. It was a matter of the majority of voters liking onion soup, and voting to ban anything but onion soup from any restaurant that received government support. Not to mention, neither revealed religion nor a commitment to reason are onion soup. They are epistemologies. Lippman took Brian's argument seriously. Jefferson had insisted that the people should not have to pay for the teachings of Anglicanism, he wrote. Mr. Bryan asked why they should be made to pay for the teaching of agnosticism. What were the implications for democracy? If a majority of voters decided that Charles Darwin was wrong and that evolution shouldn't be taught in schools, what was everyone else supposed to do? If evolution was a strong and plausible and important theory of how change occurs in nature, how could the minority of people who found the theory persuasive even begin to argue with the majority, which in a generation would consist of people who had been taught something else? Lippman decided to work through this problem by imagining a dialogue in which Jefferson and Bryan take turns making their case to Socrates, Jefferson arguing for reason and Bryan arguing for religion, but both expressing their enthusiasm for popular rule. Each presents his case, and each agrees to abide by Socrates' decision. Jefferson. And what do you conclude from all this? Socrates. That the common people hate reason, and that reason is the religion of an elite, of great gentlemen like yourself. Bryan. Reason a religion? What do you mean? Socrates. The common people have always known that reason is a religion. That is why they dislike it so violently. If the common people hate reason, Lippman concluded, there's no way a government of the people can protect the freedom of thought. The person of faith cannot accept reason as the arbiter of truth without giving up on faith. The person of reason cannot accept the truth lies outside the realm of reason. The citizens being unable to agree on basic matters of fact, they cannot agree on how to educate their children together. This is the propagandist's opportunity, Lippman wrote. With enough money, and with the tools of mass communication deployed efficiently, the propagandist can turn a political majority into a truth. Lippman had talked himself into a corner. He thought his way into a problem the Constitution had not anticipated, a problem that suggested that under these circumstances, people would not be able to rule themselves by reason and choice, as Alexander Hamilton had hoped, but would instead be ruled by accident and force. His mind grew clouded with dread. Efficiency could not solve this problem. Efficiency was part of the problem. There had to be a solution. "Gentlemen, the world is dark," Clarence Darrow once told a jury, leaning over the jury box with his broad-shouldered bulk. "But it is not hopeless." There remained the question. Where did hope lie? Chapter 11. A Constitution of the Air. Our whole business system would break down in a day if there were not a high sense of moral responsibility in our business world, said bulldog-faced Herbert Hoover while campaigning for president in 1928 at the age of 53. Hoover had earned the reputation of a savior, along with the nickname Master of Emergencies, which was also the title of his campaign film, a chronicle of his relief work in Europe during the war and in Mississippi during the 1927 flood. Featuring footage so moving, ashen, hollow children fed at last, that it reduced theater audiences to tears. One of the most devoted and talented Americans ever to seek the White House, Hoover believed that the philosophy of moral progress that had animated both American politics and American protests since the nation's founding had come to be best represented by the leaders of American businesses, private citizens who, he thought, possessed a commitment to the public interest as unwavering as his own. Nothing so well illustrated his idea of a government-business partnership as radio, an experimental technology in which Hoover, a consummate engineer, invested the hope of American democracy. As Secretary of Commerce and Undersecretary of Everything, Hoover had convened a series of annual radio conferences at the White House between 1922 and 1925, bringing together government agencies, news organizations, and manufacturers, including the fledgling Radio Corporation of America. At the time, there were 220 radio stations in the United States and 2.5 million radio sets. Telegraph and telephone lines had wired the republic together by miles of cable, like so many strings of Christmas lights, radio riding on waves of air, could go anywhere. Nevertheless, early radio sets worked like the telegraph and telephone, and were used for point-to-point communication, often ship to shore. Hoover understood that the future of radio was in broadcasting, a usage coined in 1921, transmitting a message to receivers scattered across great distances, like sowing so many seeds across a field. He rightly anticipated that radio, the nation's next great mechanical experiment, would radically transform the nature of political communication. Radio would make it possible for political candidates and office holders to speak to voters without the bother and expense of traveling to meet them. And it would also make governing an intimate affair. NBC Radio began broadcasting in 1926, CBS in 1928. By the end of the decade, nearly every household would have a wireless, often a homemade one. Hoover promised that broadcasting would make Americans literally one people. Hoover refused to leave this to chance, or to the public-mindedness of businessmen. The chaos of the early airwaves convinced him that the government had a role to play in regulating the airwaves by issuing licenses to frequencies and by insisting that broadcasters answer to the public interest. The ether is a public medium, he insisted, and its use must be for the public benefit. He pressed for the passage of the Federal Radio Act, sometimes called the Constitution of the Air. Passed in 1927, it proved to be one of the most consequential acts of progressive reform. Under the terms of the Radio Act, the Federal Radio Commission, later the Federal Communications Commission, adopted an equal time policy, and debates between political candidates became one of early radio's most popular features. Hoover would later grow troubled by the world radio had wrought. Radio lends itself to propaganda far more easily than the press, he remarked in his memoirs. But his earlier technological utopianism was widely shared. Wasn't radio, after all, the answer to the doubts about mass democracy expressed by the likes of Walter Lippmann? If the future of our democracy depends upon the intelligence and cooperation of its citizens, RCA President James G. Harbord wrote in 1929, radio may contribute to its success more than any other single influence. At the end of the 1920s, the nation's optimism appeared boundless, and not only about radio. We in America today are nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land, Hoover said in the summer of 1928, accepting the Republican nomination. We shall soon, with the help of God, be in sight of the day when poverty will be banished from this earth. American economic growth seemed unstoppable. Everything indicates that business continues to make progress with production at a new high record, the Wall Street Journal reported in July 1928, and there seems to be nothing in sight to check the upward trend. Stock market prices kept rising, at a time when stocks were no longer sold only to the wealthy. Everybody ought to be rich, argued one investor, in a magazine article in which he proposed that Americans without savings buy stocks on an installment plan. By 1929, a quarter of U.S. households owned stocks, compared to less than 1% a generation before. When Hoover was elected president in November 1928, the stock market teetered at a record high. Its closing average was three times what it had been in 1918 and twice what it had been in 1924. Hoover rode to his inauguration on a rainy Monday in March in a Pierce Arrow motor car as swank as his top hat. His reign appeared to mark the final triumph of the campaign for efficiency and prosperity, a mass democracy made orderly by public-spirited businessmen and efficiency engineers. Modern technological mind was for the first time at the head of government, wrote pioneering New York Times reporter Ann O'Hara McCormick. Almost with the air of giving genius its chance, we waited for the performance to begin. But privately, Hoover worried that the American people believed him a sort of Superman. He set to work with his customary businessman's briskness. He had a telephone installed on his desk in the Oval Office. He scheduled his appointments at 8-minute intervals. He began reorganizing the federal government. Back to the mines, he'd say, after a 15-minute lunch break. He worried about the runaway stock market, but found himself unable to halt the bull's stampede. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had soared to 240 in 1928, and the summer of 1929 it rose past 380. On October 21, 1929, Hoover, along with 500 distinguished guests, including the owners of most of America's most powerful corporations, met at Henry Ford's Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the invention of the incandescent light bulb. Light's golden jubilee was the brainchild of Edward Bernays, whose publicity campaign in advance of the event included sending incandescent light bulbs to the editors of all the nation's newspapers. On the night of the gala, electric companies all over the country shut off their electricity for 1 minute to honor Thomas Edison. 82-year-old Edison then recreated the moment when he'd first lit a light bulb. Well, on NBC, an announcer reported breathlessly, "Mr. Edison has the two wires in his hand. Now he's reaching up to the old lamp. Now he's making the connection. It lights!" That night, news came by radio that shares on the New York Stock Exchange had begun to fall. It was as if a light, too brightly lit, had shattered. 1. Darkness had already fallen on Europe, which was well into a depression by 1928, a consequence of the political settlement that had ended the First World War. Before the autumn of 1929, the United States had appeared beyond the reach of that shadow. But then, over 3 weeks, the Dow Jones fell from 326 to 198. Stocks lost nearly 40% of their value. At first, the market rallied. By March 1930, stocks traded on the Dow Jones had regained nearly 75% of the value they'd lost. Still, the economy teetered, and then it tottered. A depression set in, and by late spring, stock prices were once again plummeting. Hoover, master of emergencies, steered the country through the crash. But when the Depression began, he did very little except to wait for a recovery, an attempt to reassure a panicked public. He believed in charity, but he did not believe in government relief, arguing that if the United States were to provide it, the nation would be plunged into socialism and collectivism. When Hoover did act, it was to sever the United States from Europe. He pulled up America's last financial drawbridge by convincing Congress to pass a new punitive trade bill, the 1930 Tariff Act. Other nations, retaliating, soon passed their own trade restrictions. Up came their drawbridges. World trade shrank by a quarter. U.S. imports fell. In 1929, the United States had imported $4.4 billion in foreign products. In 1930, imports declined to $3.1 billion. Then, U.S. exports fell. To protect American wheat farmers, the tariff on imported grain had been increased by almost 50%. But by 1931, American farmers found themselves able to sell only about 10% of their crops. Creditors seized farms and sold them off at auction. Foreign debtors, unable to sell their goods in the United States, proved unable to pay back their debts to American creditors. Between 1929 and 1932, 1 in 5 American banks failed. The unemployment rate climbed from 9% in 1930 to 16% in 1931 to 23% in 1932. By which time nearly 12 million Americans, a number equal to the entire population of the state of New York, were out of work. By 1932, national income, $87.4 billion in 1929, had fallen to $41.7 billion. In many homes, family income fell to zero. 1 in 4 Americans suffered from want of food. Factories closed, farms were abandoned, even the weather conspired to reduce Americans to want. A drought plagued the plains, sowing despair and reaping death. Soil turned to dust and blew away. Schools shut their doors, children grew thin and even thinner, and babies died in their cradles. Farm families, displaced by debt and drought, wandered westward, carrying what they could in dust-covered jalopies. The experiment in democracy that had begun with American independence seemed on the very edge of defeat. At no time since the rise of political democracy have its tenets been so seriously challenged as they are today, was the proclamation of the New Republic, introducing a series on the future of self-government. All over the world, democracies were collapsing under the weight of the masses. The Russian, Ottoman, and Austrian empires had fallen apart, producing by 1918 more than a dozen new states, many of which, like Lithuania, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Poland, experimented with democracy but did not endure as democracies. The tally was bleak, and each year bleaker, as one European nation after another turned to fascism or another form of authoritarianism. The long 19th century's movement toward constitutional government, the rule of law, representative assemblies, and the abdication of dictatorship, the application to modern life of 18th century ideas about reason and debate, inquiry and equality, had come to a halt and begun a reversal. Hardly a week passed without another learned commentator declaring the experiment a failure. "Epitaphs for democracy are the fashion of the day," the legal scholar Felix Frankfurter remarked in 1930. In 1931, men and women all over the world were seriously contemplating and frankly discussing the possibility that the Western system of society might break down and cease to work. the British historian Arnold J. Toynbee observed that fateful year. Representative democracy seems to have ended in a cul-de-sac, wrote the political theorist Harold Laski in 1932. The last peace had created the conditions for the next war. Out of want came fear, out of fear came fury. By 1930, more than 3 million Germans were unemployed, and Nazi Party membership had doubled. Adolf Hitler, as addled as he was ruthless, came to power in 1933, invaded the Rhineland in 1936, Poland in 1939. The bells of history tolled a tragedy of ages. Japan, whose expansion had been prohibited by the League of Nations, invaded Manchuria in 1931 and Shanghai in 1937. Italy's dictator Benito Mussolini, Il Duce, thirsting for glory and for the triumphs and trophies of war, invaded Ethiopia in 1935. Tyrants ruled with the terror of lies, led by the Reich's Ministry of Propaganda. Mussolini predicted, "The liberal state is destined to perish." Much appeared to rest on the fate of the United States and its search for a new way, a third way, between laissez-faire capitalism and a state-run economy. It has fallen to us to live in one of those conjunctures of human affairs which mark a crisis in the habits, the customs, the routine, the inherited method, and the traditional ideas of mankind, Walter Lippmann announced in a speech in Berkeley in 1933. "The old relationships among the great masses of people of the earth have disappeared," he said. "The fixed points by which our fathers steered the ship of state have vanished." Was the ship of state lost at sea? We are all of us, more or less primitive men, as lynchings illustrate dramatically, and fascism systematically, the historian Charles Beard wrote bitterly in 1934. The great masses of the people had insisted on their right to rule, but their rule, it turned out, was dangerous. So easily were they deceived by propaganda. The liberal culture of modernity is quite unable to give guidance and direction to a confused generation, which faces the disintegration of social system and the task of building a new one, the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr wrote that year in the aptly titled Reflections on the End of an Era. One set of political arrangements had come to an end. It remained to be seen what set of arrangements would replace them. After the stock market crash, voters rejected both Hoover's leadership and that of his party. In the 1930 midterm elections, Republicans lost 52 seats in the House. Advisors urged Hoover to address the nation in weekly 10-minute radio broadcasts to offer comfort and solace and direction. He refused. Few voices were less well-suited to the new medium. Hoover spoke on the radio 95 times during his presidency. But during the handful of broadcasts in which he did more than issue a strained greeting, he read from a script in a dreadful monotone. "No one with a spark of human sympathy can contemplate unmoved the possibilities of suffering that can crush many of our unfortunate fellow Americans if we shall fail them," he said once, reading a well-written and even stirring speech, but sounding like an overworked principal at a middle school graduation, listlessly announcing the names of graduating students from a lectern in a gray-green auditorium. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was untroubled by any such awkwardness. He wore a wide-brimmed hat and wireless round eyeglasses. His daintiness, a certain fussiness of person, earned him the nickname Feather Duster Roosevelt. But if he had a patrician style, he spoke on the radio with an easy intimacy and a ready charm, coming across as knowledgeable, patient, kind-hearted, and firm of purpose. He spoke, he liked to say, with the quiet of common sense and friendliness. Hoover, a man of humble origins, dedicated to public service, would come to be seen as having turned his back on the suffering of the poorest of Americans. Roosevelt, raised as an aristocrat, would be remembered as their champion. Born in Hyde Park in 1882, Roosevelt, as a young man, had much admired his distant cousin, lion-hunting Theodore Roosevelt, and even emulated him. "Delighted," he would say, "and bully!" He was elected to the Senate in 1910, at the age of 28, as a Democrat. 3 years later, Wilson appointed him Assistant Secretary of the Navy. By 1920, he'd risen to the rank of presidential running mate. But the next year, his political career appeared to be over when, at the age of 39, he contracted polio and lost the use of both of his legs. Confined to a wheelchair in private, he disguised his condition from the public by using leg braces and a cane, walking only with great pain. It was his paralysis, his wife Eleanor said, that taught Roosevelt what suffering meant. His acquaintance with anguish changed his voice. It made it warmer. Hoover understood the importance of radio. Roosevelt knew how to use it. In 1928, delivering a nominating address to the Democratic National Convention, the first convention broadcast on the air, Roosevelt felt and sounded as though he was addressing not the audience in Madison Square Garden, but Americans across the country. He'd then honed his skills as a radio broadcaster as governor of New York, delivering regular reports to the people from WOKO in Albany. The state's newspapers were predominantly Republican. To bypass them, Roosevelt delivered a monthly radio address, reaching voters directly. In 1932, he stumped for the Democratic nomination on behalf of a new brand of liberalism that borrowed as much from Bryan's populism as from Wilson's progressivism. "The history of the last half century is in large measure a history of a group of financial titans," Roosevelt said in a rally in San Francisco. "But the day of the great promoter or the financial titan to whom we granted anything if only he would build or develop is over." When Roosevelt at the governor's mansion in Albany heard on the radio that he'd been nominated at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, he called the hall and said that he was on his way. While delegates, along with an expectant radio audience, waited, Roosevelt flew to Chicago, his plane refueling in Cleveland. No presidential nominee had ever shown up to accept the nomination in person. "But the times were strange," Roosevelt said, "and they called for change. Let it, from now on, be the task of our party to break foolish traditions." In his rousing acceptance speech broadcast live, he promised Americans a new deal. "I pledge you, I pledge myself, to a new deal for the American people," he told the roaring crowd in Chicago Stadium, straw hats waving. "Let us all here assembled constitute ourselves prophets of a new order of competence and of courage. This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms. Give me your help, not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade, to restore America to its own people." Republicans often said, as they'd said about William Jennings Bryan, that while listening to Roosevelt, they found themselves agreeing with him even when they didn't. "All that man has to do is speak on the radio, and the sound of his voice, his sincerity, and the manner of his delivery, it just melts me," one said. Hoover compared Roosevelt to Bryan not only in style but in substance, describing the New Deal as nothing more than Bryanism under new words and methods. That wasn't really true as a matter of politics and constituencies, but there were undeniable similarities. "The New Deal is as old as Christian ethics, for basically its ethics are the same," Roosevelt liked to say. "It recognizes that man is indeed his brother's keeper, insists that the laborer is worthy of his hire, demands that justice shall rule the mighty as well as the weak." Still, much was new in Roosevelt's presidency, beginning with his campaign. The stump speeches he delivered on stages all over the country were the first presidential campaign speeches recorded on film and screened in movie theaters as newsreels. After accepting the nomination, he began delivering nationwide radio addresses from the governor's mansion, each speech more disarming than the last. "I hope, during this campaign, to use the radio frequently to speak to you about the important things that concern us all," he told his audience. "I want you to hear me tonight as I sit here in my own home, away from the excitement of the campaign, and with only a few of the family and a few personal friends present." Most Americans had only ever heard national political candidates shouting, trying to project their voices across a banquet hall or a football field. Hearing Roosevelt speak quietly and calmly, as if he were sitting across the kitchen table having a reasonable argument with you, earned him Americans' dedicated affection. "It was a God-given gift," his wife said. "He could talk to people so that they felt he was talking to them individually." In November, Roosevelt trounced Hoover, beating him 472-59 in the Electoral College and winning 42 out of 48 states. The simplest explanation was that the public blamed Hoover for the Depression. But there was more to the rout. FDR's election also ushered in a new party system, as the Democratic and Republican parties rearranged themselves around what came to be called the New Deal Coalition, which brought together blue-collar workers, Southern farmers, racial minorities, liberal intellectuals, and even industrialists, and still more strangely, women. With roots in 19th-century populism and early 20th-century progressivism, FDR's ascension marked the rise of modern liberalism. But FDR's election and the New Deal Coalition also marked a turning point in another way, in the character and ambition of his wife, the indomitable Eleanor Roosevelt. Born in New York in 1884, she'd been orphaned as a child. She married FDR, her fifth cousin, in 1905. They had six children. 9 years into their marriage, Franklin began an affair with Eleanor's social secretary. And when Eleanor found out, he refused to agree to a divorce, fearing it would end his career in politics. Eleanor turned her energies outward. During the war, she worked on international relief, and after Franklin was struck with polio in 1921, she began speaking in public, heeding a call that brought so many women to the stage for the first time. She was sent to appear in her husband's stead.